The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the University of Alberta, the Students Union, or CJSR.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello, and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. Today we'll dig into the wonderful world of your brain. What's the relationship between intelligence, talent, and genetics? Is DNA responsible for your brilliance? Or can hard work mean more? We'll be joined later on in the episode by David Shank, author of The Genius in All of Us, Why Everything You've Been Told About Genetics, Talent, and IQ is Wrong. I have a few announcements to start us off. First, we here at Skeptically Speaking just want to send out a big happy anniversary to Skepticality, who recently celebrated 5 years of podcasting goodness. Skepticality, the first official podcast of Skeptic Magazine, was also the first skeptical podcast ever. They started this whole thing. If not for them, this show, the one you're listening to right now, might not exist. So Derek, Swoopy, two of the nicest people on this planet, thank you. We wish you many more years of awesome. And we'd also like to say hello to a new station, CFAD 92.1 FM in Salmo, British Columbia. Now, Salmo is right next door to both Creston and Nelson, and their stations also air our fine program. So I just want to say, small town BC, you are our kind of people. Welcome aboard CFAD. Happy to have you with us. And now to Speaking Up. We're here today with Steve Toms, editor of SkepticNorth.com, the Canadian Skeptical Blog Collective. And he's here to promote Homeopathy Awareness Week. Welcome, Steve.
Hello, thank you. And, well, see, I don't know whether I want to say that we're promoting Homeopathy Awareness Week, but we are trying to offer a skeptic or a scientific response to it.
So maybe explain, first of all, what is Homeopathy Awareness Week regularly?
Well, regularly, it's a week of awareness of homeopathy. It's usually hosted by these various international homeopathy organizations around this time of year, every year. And it's meant to inform the general public about the supposed benefits of homeopathy. And in the past few years, Awareness Week activities in Canada have had very little skeptic or science-based responses. So now that we have Skeptic North, the whole purpose of us is to come together and be skeptics together. And this is one of the things that we're able to respond to as per our mandate.
So for anybody who doesn't know, how do homeopaths claim that homeopathy works?
Homeopathy is a 200-plus-year-old alternative health treatment that teaches that you can somehow dilute a substance in water so much so that the original substance is gone, and somehow that makes the treatment more potent and more effective. It's also based on the principle of like cures like, so that a homeopathic cure for sneezing would be black pepper. At least it would be if it, you know, wasn't so diluted. And in the words of James Randi, he said, you can take a substance that will cure your thing, and then you don't do that. One of the things that I did, fascinated by these various homeopathic remedies, I looked into some of the treatments that they say that you can dilute. And I think that a balanced approach to Homeopathy Awareness Week would be to include what homeopaths themselves claim that you can actually dilute and use as a treatment. Like a while back, Phil Plait mentioned that sunlight reflected off of Saturn, you could dilute that. Or diluted dog feces, diluted exhaust fumes, the essence of the Milky Way galaxy, Coca-Cola.
For real.
I don't know how they bottled the essence. I suspect Dungeons and Dragons are involved. Something called black hole is also in there, but you know, my personal favorite is Tyrannosaurus Rex. I don't know how they got their hands on a T-Rex fossil or why they decided that the best thing to do would be to grind it up and dilute it out of existence. But I might be concerned if they had a piece of an actual T-Rex fossil. But since these things are diluted out of existence, I'm pretty sure that you could have nothing but sugar and milk in it, and there'd be no way that even the homeopaths could tell the difference between a T-Rex remedy and another one of my favorites, laser beam. And since like cures like, I'm really curious as to what they think that taking diluted black hole is supposed to cure you of. Like, gravity? Hard to see?
So, I hesitate to ask, but what does science say about this?
Science first will chuckle an awful lot, but after the derision has died off, they look at things like Avogadro's number, which is a mathematical concept, and it also works in chemistry, and it just says that you can dilute a substance only to a certain point before the original chemical is gone. But of course, the homeopaths go way past that number when they do their dilutions of 10 million kind of things. One particular dilution of homeopathy is if you were to take a grain of rice and put it in a sphere of water that extends to the orbit of Saturn. And one thing I forgot to mention is that to the homeopath, the more dilute you make it, the stronger it becomes. So that grain of rice in the sphere of Saturn, you got to believe that's some pretty strong stuff.
So effectively, there's nothing left of the initial substance, really.
Depending on the dilution, but most of the time, there is nothing of the original substance. There's milk and some binding agents and various things that go into making any pill, really. Homeopaths generally rely on the placebo effect at that point.
So you do mention the black hole and such, but can you say the more moderate homeopaths, what they would use?
Well, I can't say what is moderate and what is extreme homeopathic, because this information comes from a website for homeopath suppliers. They can just buy whatever they want. And clearly, I mean, whatever they want. But like some homeopathic treatments have things like acorn ground up, or various roots and herbs. One of the misconceptions that a lot of people have is that homeopathy is synonymous with naturopathy. And that's just not the case, because I mentioned Coca-Cola earlier. You can also dilute arsenic and give that as a remedy. You can dilute the H1N1 vaccine and give that out. But of course, it's diluted so much that it's not there anymore, but, you know, it is pretty self-defeating at that point.
But primarily, homeopathy seems to work, if at all, solely due to the placebo effect.
I would agree with that assessment, yes. One of the things that the homeopaths rely on is very vague diagnoses of wellness and treating the whole person and energy, sex drive, things that are really, really, really hard to quantify. Pain is another one, that we will cure your back pain, which usually gets extended to curing arthritis, which is a different thing altogether. But one of the problems is that when you only target for a placebo effect, say you are treating for pain, and that pain is underlying a much more serious health condition like arthritis or osteoporosis, and all you're doing is treating the pain, well, meanwhile, you have osteoarthritis developing in the background, and you're ignoring it.
That's sort of similar to something I was thinking. I was looking at some of the outreach events that homeopaths are offering this week. And on World Homeopathy site, they're offering things like lectures on homeopathy for behavioral problems in children, homeopathic essential cleansing, and treating menopause symptoms naturally with homeopathy. Two of those things are very much emotionally based.
By trade, I'm a teacher, and I do have some kids with some behavioral issues. If their parents were treating them with homeopathy, that make my job much more difficult. Because if they're only getting placebo sugar pills, and they have psychological or sociological issues to deal with, they're not being treated. They're being treated with placebos. But some of these kids that have really severe psychological and sociological issues that need to be dealt with, and they're not getting treated. They're getting treated with sugar pills and milk pills. Meanwhile, they're developing problems that will manifest later in life. And that's ultimately victimizes the child.
So with all of this in mind, what's the state of homeopathy in Canada right now?
Well, there's two things that I take exception to with the state of homeopathy in Canada. One is that Health Canada is complicit in giving legitimacy to homeopathy because they assign a unique, quote, drug identification number homeopathic medicine, a DINHM, to each, quote unquote, approved homeopathic medication. That's a huge stamp of legitimacy to a placebo sugar pill. I got a real problem with that. And that's one of the things that we're going to hopefully address and get that knowledge out there. And the other thing is that homeopathy in Canada is fairly self-regulated. There are homeopathic governing bodies, but membership in these bodies is entirely voluntary, and the state doesn't require a practicing homeopath to be a member of these organizations. Now, if you were to contrast that with physiotherapy or pharmacy, like say if you just wanted to call yourself a pharmacist and then start handing out medications, you'd face criminal charges. So why is there this horrible double standard for a 200-year-old fake medicine that we know doesn't work anymore?
So you're saying I could technically set up shop in my house, add a little bit of stuff to water, and shake it up a bunch of times. And for those of you who don't know, that's called succussion. Can you explain succussion, Steve?
Succussion? I always known it as succession. Whatever. That word
I could be saying it wrong.
Well, that word that you said, there are two ways to do that thing. One way is that at each stage of dilution, you hit it three times. Makes sense to me. And the other way is if you shake the thing, but you got to do it a really particular way. You have to shake it 10 times forward, 10 times side to side, and 10 times up and down. And the reason you do that is because it will be in all three dimensions. Duh.
So you're saying there's no regulation for the magic, which is homeopathy? Because that sounds like magic to me.
It does sound like magic because, like, I've played enough Dungeons & Dragons in my day to know that a lot of these people are just the dice throw away from making a saving throw.
You spoke my language, sir. I understand your reference.
Dice.
So how is Skeptic North celebrating this occasion?
Well, we don't really celebrate this sort of thing, but we do have the whole week set aside. And we're going to be providing science and skeptic-based contributions to Homeopathy Awareness Week. We'll have videos, infographs, investigations, all manner of information that the homeopaths themselves might not be so willing to share. Some of them will be pretty serious, some of them might be a little bit sad, but some of them will also be kind of funny and lighthearted. A few months ago, a reader sent to me a notice about a discussion on the Skeptic Reddit site, where a bunch of Canadian skeptics were asking what could be done about a guy named Bryce Wilde, who's a Toronto area homeopath who has regular airtime on CP24. And that's television, not radio. And he does his homeopathic thing about how you can use homeopathy for this or that. And so some people asked what could be done. And somebody else said, well, why not Skeptic North? Seems like their kind of thing. And actually, it is our kind of thing. That issue indeed will be covered during Homeopathy Awareness Week. And also, most of our members also run their own skeptic blogs or science-based blogs, and some of us will have homeopathic discussions, which we will link to as well.
So April 10th to 16th, it is all homeopathy all the time at skepticnorth.com.
That's true.
I'm very much looking forward to your public awareness campaign, sir.
Well, thank you very much.
And thanks for being here, Steve.
I'm glad you had me on.
If you'd like to know more about what actual science says about homeopathy, do head to skepticnorth.com. And we'll be right back with more Skeptically Speaking after these short messages.
You are listening to Skeptically Speaking, either through the wonder of podcast technology or the generosity of one of our rebroadcasting stations. Skeptically Speaking is broadcast live out of CJSR 88.5 Edmonton, Alberta at 6 p.m. Mountain Time every Friday. If you're not in Edmonton, you can still hear the broadcast live on our Ustream.tv feed, which you can find by clicking on the Listen Live link on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also participate in the chat room and submit questions. During the week leading up to each show, you can find information on the upcoming episode and guest and submit a question to be asked in the air. You can also subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Our deepest thanks go to those stations that donate their valuable airtime to our program, including Citywide LP FM 99.1 in Madison, Wisconsin, CILY, Kootenai Cooperative Radio 93.5 FM in Nelson, 96.5 FM in Crawford Bay, and 107.5 FM in New Denver, British Columbia, CIVL 101.7 FM in Abbotsford, British Columbia, CJAI, Amherst Island Public Radio, 92.1 FM in Stella, Ontario. CLHI, Rosslyn Radio 101.1 FM in Rosslyn, British Columbia. Freethought Radio. WPRR, Public Reality Radio, 1680 AM in Grand Rapids, Michigan. CIDO, 97.7 FM in Creston, British Columbia. UMFM 101.7 FM in Winnipeg, Manitoba, and CFAD 92.1 FM in Salmo, British Columbia.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. We're here with David Shank, best-selling American author, lecturer, and filmmaker. He's the author of five books, including Data Smog, The Forgetting, and The Immortal Game. But he's here today to talk about his new book, The Genius in All of Us, Why Everything You've Been Told About Genetics, Talent, and IQ is Wrong. Welcome to Skeptically Speaking, David.
Thank you, Desiree. Thanks for having me.
So when you use the word genius, what does that mean?
Genius is really is one of those words that really gets people's attention. You know, the book is really about talent and intelligence and about trying to help people, encourage people to just be, to shoot for greatness, you know, to shoot for excellence. And I actually don't really care much about making a definition of genius. Obviously, it's a stand-in for, you know, for people, you know, at the very top of whatever field it is. But I don't really spend any time in the book or any other time outside the book worrying about the distinction between genius and whatever the next step is slightly below genius.
Right. But you also include artistic creativity and even athletic ability in whatever definition that is.
Yeah, for the purpose of the book, I'm referring to high achievement in any domain at all, you know, and I mean any domain you can think of, just being very, very good at something or great or superb or whatever the adjective you want to use is what I'm talking about. And that includes just being smart. And the point of the book actually is to help people get away from this artificial distinction of people who are supposedly born with a certain something that makes them geniuses or makes them destined for greatness in some field or another. Usually people think they're destined by their genes. That's the kind of the current currency that drives that myth. And to start to realize that becoming great is a process. We don't really fully control the process, but the more we understand the process, the more we can control it, and the more control we can have over the direction of our lives.
What do you see as the popular conception of how genes influence those abilities?
Well, let's see. I mean, there are different pieces to it, but the piece that I'm kind of trying to drive hard against is this idea that there is something called natural born ability or innate talent or gene given IQ. You know, all these giftedness is another term. You know, he's just naturally gifted at whatever they're talking about, soccer or math or painting or whatever. This idea that somehow that someone just has a gene or a set of genes that just gives them that magic stuff and separates him or her from the rest of us.
So I just want to make sure we don't have a straw man here. People really do believe that genes kind of guarantee destiny?
Gattaca? No. Thank you for clarifying.
Okay.
I think the common conception is that there's nature and there's nurture, and that and that the people who are really, really good at stuff obviously work at it. I don't think there's anyone who thinks that someone is just born, you know, with a violin in their hand and it just starts playing, or that things come, you know, really easy to super great achievers. But I'm fairly confident that I don't know if it's everyone, but enormous number of people do believe that the people who are truly great could not have gotten to where they are without some kind of secret, special genetic thing that they've got, that they were born with, that that mere mortals don't have. So that, you know, I could work really, really hard. I could work just as hard as Michael Jordan, and I'm never going to be the basketball player that he is. I could work just as hard as Tiger Woods, and I'm never going to be, you know, the golfer that Tiger Woods is.
So that's really what we're talking about here, is it's not just nature and or nurture. There's a third kind of major influence on extraordinary achievement.
Well, what I'm trying to do is, and feel free to disagree if you think that the way I just described it is a straw man. But what I'm trying to do is put different pieces of science together and help people get past the idea of separating nature from nurture, and particularly separating them with the belief that nature comes first and kind of delivers a certain thing to us that is separate from nurture. And one key part of that is understanding that genes are not destiny. Genes are we all have different genes, to be sure. We all have genetic differences, and those genetic differences are going to yield differences in our lives. There's no question. But how those genes actually affect us is really, I think, very widely misunderstood. Very few people understand that genes actually respond to the environment, that they're more like switches that get turned on and off, and that it's much more of an interactive thing. So that really puts the lie to this idea that it's the nature that comes first and then the nurture comes after that, and that really just kind of, you know, polishes off what we were given by our genes.
Audience, if you have a question on genes, environment, and hard work, and what means what, email live at skepticallyspeaking.com or tweet us at Skeptical Radio. So you mentioned environmental influences. So what kind of environmental influences?
Well, I don't think there are any environmental influences. I don't think there's anything in our environment that isn't influential. And I don't pretend in the book to have rounded them all up by any means. In fact, a big part of trying to help people create a more nuanced picture of this whole thing is to help explain that when we shift away from a nature/nurture way of thinking, it doesn't mean we're shifting away from nature toward nurture. It doesn't mean that by saying that genes don't determine who you are, it means that we automatically have more control over or anything like total control over who we become. What it means is that this whole thing that we call our lives is a process. It's a developmental process, and everything is involved. I mean, there isn't really anything that from the air we breathe to the food we eat to the levels of stress and energy that we have in our moment-to-moment lives, to the music we listen to, the thoughts we have. There isn't anything that isn't somehow or another interacting with the genes in our body, and of course, eventually the brain in our head. So it's all this interactive, dynamic process that's going on, and what that means is that we are going to become something. We're gonna have some kind of identity, some kind of personality. We're gonna have certain nuanced kind of suite of psychological motivations. We're gonna be good at stuff and bad at other stuff. But none of that stuff is by any means predestined by this genome that we get the moment we're conceived. All of it really is in play, and the more we understand that at whatever age we're listening to this and contemplating this, you know, we're already down a certain path, to be sure, which means that we have, you know, limitations and advantages already by, you know, the certain pathway that we've gone down. But even that path is just one of many paths that we could have taken. And if we think kind of holistically about what humans can become, not just in this generation, but many generations on down the line, I think that understanding it as a process, as a dynamic process, is going to help us come to smarter decisions on many, many different levels.
We have a caller. Hi, that's Rudy.
Hi. Yeah, that's correct. Hi, I'm just going to kind of got a question kind of regarding kind of what you're saying, just to, like, the concept of perfect pitch.
Yep.
In terms of music, and I'm kind of wondering, like, is it something that you, like, are you saying that it's something that this is not something that you necessarily are born with, or that it's something that is developed over time as a younger person, or is it something that is really only the only certain people can have it?
They actually call it absolute pitch, but the popular term is perfect pitch. So what he's talking about is this idea that you can be completely out of a context from any musical tone, and someone can just play you a note, and you can say, "Oh, that's an A flat." You just have a somehow kind of an internal memory, kind of the way the rest of us easily look at a color and go, "Oh, that's purple." We know what that is. We don't have to compare a color to another color to know, to know what to call it. Well, some people have absolute pitch, and they can just hear a tone completely out of context and say, "Oh, that's an E." And the answer is unequivocally, but the evidence, and I do write about this in my books explicitly, the evidence is strongly pointing to this notion that that virtually all human beings are actually born with the potential to develop absolute pitch, and that some people, whether or not you actually develop it, occurs very early on. Very, very early on, and that the potential to develop it gets cut off very early on, and it basically depends on your tonal environment. So one of the ways they know this is that you can go to countries and cultures where language is more tonally based, like Asian countries, various Asian countries, and you have a much higher percentage of people who end up with perfect pitch. That in itself doesn't prove anything, of course, but that's the current understanding of people who study this, is that something as basic as that is not something that is just kind of held inside a gene that just by genetic lottery someone's going to have perfect pitch and another person isn't. It's more a matter of development. And I'm not saying that everyone, that everyone can develop it, or that we can come up with the right recipe, or that we're ever going to, have, all the answers to that. But again, it does shift it more to the, very much more to the developmental realm.
So environment is important, and genes also play a role. But what are there any more kind of environmental influences that are more important than others?
Sure. Yeah. There are more important influences and less important influences, but it's hard to answer that question out of context. I mean, what are we talking about? You want to talk about a certain skill at a certain age in a certain context, and I can give you my, a more specific reaction to that question. I mean, it really depends. If you're talking about a baby who in utero who is 1 week old, they're going to be, depending on what's going on with the obviously very, very initial formation of the nervous system and other things, there are going to be things that matter tremendously in terms of the nutrition and stress levels of the mother and probably temperature and really basic things like that. And other things are not going to matter at all. But if you're talking about a 10-year-old kid, who's trying to learn, baseball for the first time, obviously there are going to be things that come to the foreground that take precedence.
So this is totally situational.
I think so. Yeah, okay. I'm trying to think of how it wouldn't be, but yeah, right. I mean that's my sense, is that it is totally a matter of context.
You've come to some interesting findings around twins.
Yes. Again, that's a big setup. You want to be more specific, and I'll follow where you're going, because I there's a whole chapter on this, and it's
there is
talk about it for hours.
Well, just some of the differences, let's say, in twins that were raised in different environments. Some of the differences that you've seen.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, twins are very interesting, and they're very useful for study. I'll try to kind of make this, as brief as I can. I'll end up being long-winded about it, and you can just jump in and cut me off. But
okay.
I'm going to be acknowledging some things, and I'm going to be then kind of fighting back against some common understandings on a few other points.
To make it simpler for everyone concerned,
sure.
You have come to some different findings than many other people.
Well, I have to give the context to do this.
I'm okay. I tried.
I'm sorry.
That's fine.
If you think it's too big,
no, absolutely not.
But it's really difficult just to jump in and say. I'll try to make it very brief. Basically, there is a whole body of twin study research, which has been going on for a couple of decades, and basically looking at the differences in personality and intelligence and a few other things that are quote-unquote measurable, although those things are actually very difficult to measure in some regard. But looking at the differences in some of those attributes between fraternal twins who share on average 50% of their genes, and then comparing that statistically to the differences that are measurable between identical twins who have pretty close to 100% genetic similarity, although it's not actually 100%, but it's very, very close. And from those studies, and there have been many, many studies on this, and this has been duplicated, and there's enough studies that are basically showing the same thing to show that there is something that they're coming up that's worthwhile here. I'm not at all trying to shoot down the whole era of twin study research, but from these studies, they've come up with this this idea that you can statistically separate the genetic influence of things like personality and intelligence from the environmental influence. So they have a word for that. The word is heritable. So they say that intelligence, average it all out, and intelligence is supposedly 60% heritable. And then that gets in the newspapers and someone thinks, oh, that means my intelligence is 60% coming from genes.
Right.
And, to follow the second statement from the first statement is so crazily unconnected and untrue that I can only come to the conclusion that using the word heritable, and allowing that word to be to kind of leak into public conversation and to be interpreted as meaning inherited is incredibly reckless. I mean, incredibly reckless and arguably fraudulent, because it really, really is not what it means. It's not what that means. They're talking about a statistical sampling that is coming up with this way of separation, but we actually know that's not how biology works. Number one, you actually cannot separate biologically the genetic influence from the environmental influence. So to try to do it statistically is misleading in the extreme. What twin studies are showing, without a shadow of a doubt now, and it is useful, is that there is genetic influence on everything we do. But to take it further and to put numbers on it and to talk about it being attributes being a certain percentage heritable is very, very, very misleading. And I think has actually taken what was already a pretty poor general understanding of genetics, say, 30 years ago, and has kind of put some icing on it and made it even shinier and worse, because we've missed an opportunity over the last 20 or 30 years to better inform the public and give them a much more nuanced understanding of how genes work. But instead, heritability studies and how they're reported, and I'm blaming some scientists for this, and I'm also blaming some science journalists for this, have really kind of moved us backward in terms of understanding how these things really work.
We have a question from the chat room.
Can genetics lead us towards certain preferences? Has this sort of thing been studied for children who grow up in the same or similar environments? And that's from Noisy Astronomer.
I guess that they're meaning like taste preferences and idea preferences. You want to try to?
I would go with that.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, I mean, genetics is actually kind of banking off of what I just said.
Mm-hmm.
I'll say it very clearly again. just so that people don't misunderstand me, I am absolutely not trying to limit the notion that, that there is genetic influence on everything we do. But it's how the genes influence us that people need to understand. So there's no question that genes, and your particular set of genes, whoever asked that question, is going to influence your personality, your tastes, your intelligence. But from there, what you need to very quickly understand is that we could clone you, and your clone is actually going to end up with pretty different attributes and all the things I just named, and in every other way too. The reason that is that your genes are only producing effects through the interaction with the certain environment that you have gone through so far, most prominently in the womb and then early on in your physical development, but continuing on actually throughout life. And unless your clone is having the exact same environmental influences, which is actually next to impossible unless you're an identical twin. And even once identical twins are born, they're having all sorts of differences in environment, and then thus becoming actually sometimes very, very different people. It's how the genes influence you that needs to be better understood.
Well, I believe that partially answers a question that we've received from the chat room. Just to make sure, go ahead.
Okay.
Can you share your experiences with the cat and its clone and how they're surprisingly different? That's from 40-year-old atheist.
Yes. This may be someone who's seen a recent talk that I've given or seen a video of it, because I've now given a couple of talks where I show some slides. And one of the slides, or a couple of the slides, are photographs of a cat named Rainbow who was cloned. I'm really bad on dates. I think it was 2001, I believe, and it was in Texas. I think University of Texas at Austin. And what's amazing to look at visually, although not surprising to the people who understand genes, but it's just amazing to show people the picture of the clone, because the clone looks nothing like Rainbow. They have very different fur color schemes. One is essentially a gray and white cat, and the other one is essentially a calico colored cat. And the point there is that they have the same genes, and this is just kind of an illustration or an example of what I was just saying. They have the same genes, and yet in utero there was a very different gene environment interaction going on there, and lo and behold, very different looking cats. And I should say that the clone cat's name was Cece, which makes it even funnier, carbon copy. And when you look at them side by side, you're obviously not looking at a carbon copy.
I love nerd humor. Let's talk about the work aspect of this. Where does the hard work come in?
Well, it's hard to be good at stuff. Anyone who's gotten reasonably or very good or very, very good or superb at something knows that it's something that takes a long time. It takes not only a lot of focus and persistence and willpower and passion and not just a lot of time in the short term, but often almost always over a long period of time. So not just many hours, concentrated of practice in a given, week or so, but over months and months and years, depending on how good you want to be. And then on top of all that, it takes a very particular attitude towards failure. And I think one of the key lessons for me in the book, at least, is that I think that you could look at the world almost as being in two different camps. One camp thinks of failure as a revelation of the stuff they don't have and the things they'll never be. They don't do well on a test in math, and they think, I'm not good at math. And that's reinforced by the people in their lives and comments they've heard and also just the feeling of just, wow, I just don't get this stuff. So it's kind of, you know, it's you fail at something and you and it's a bad. No one likes to fail, of course, but some people interpret that feeling as being this kind of exposure of who they are, and they just don't want to experience that feeling again, so they're not gonna go back and take that more advanced math class and you know try to and keep you know risk keep experiencing that awful feeling.
Right.
And the second camp are people who somehow, whether it's through a teacher or their parents or the stuff they read or hear incidentally, or some kind of experience. Often it's an experience, a particular experience of adversity that teaches them this lesson. Somehow the second camp learns the lesson that when you fail at something, it's not a revelation or an exposure of who you are and what you can and can't do. It's a revelation and an exposure of what you haven't yet learned to do. It's a revelation of a very specific skill that you don't yet have. Other people have it, you don't, plenty of others don't, and it becomes a question of whether or not you want to acquire that skill and whether or not you're, not whether you have what it takes to do it, but whether you want to put the time and the determination and have also the wherewithal, the right teachers, and you know many of these things are actually beyond your individual control, but whether or not you are going to go seize that particular skill. And what you look at, what you see when you look at the actual kind of hour-to-hour lives of great adult achievers is that at some point in their lives, sometimes it's, you know, when they're 2, sometimes it's when they're 10, sometimes, you know, it's not till they're 25 or 30, they realize that that the way to respond to failure, if you want to become good at something or great at something, is to think of it as an opportunity, to think of it as an insight, and to actually, as you're practicing your craft or pushing yourself in your craft, depending on what it is, every day you actually want to fail because you want to learn what you don't yet know, or you want to be exposed for the skill you don't yet have so that you can very specifically focus on that task. Maybe the easiest way to think about this is Michael Jordan, you know, sitting alone in a big gym shooting shots, and instead of shooting the ones that he's already, you know, hitting, you know, 85% of the time, he's going to the part of the gym or taking the particular shot where he's, you know, he's down in the low, you know, the 5 to 10% range, and so that's the stuff he's going to work on, you know, instead of shooting with his right hand, he's going to shoot where he's doing so well. He's going to shoot with his left hand.
Now, I find this interesting because this is not the first time I've heard this. Adam Savage, one of the hosts of the TV show MythBusters, he was on the show last year, and one of the things that he said really struck me. He said, if you want to get good at something, you have to obsess. Would you agree with that?
I would agree with that, but instead of good, I would say if you want to be really, really good at something. I don't think I don't think you need to be obsessed with something if you just want to get good at it. But yeah, if you want to be great, if you want to be a really high achiever in whatever field it is you're pursuing there, you've got to really want it, and you've got to be willing to work at it in this way that we're talking about, that really, you know, that exposes what you can't do, and it has a kind of a constantly self-critical piece to it, instead of like a self-proud thing, like, hey, look at this sentence I just wrote, aren't I a great writer? It's more like, okay, I just wrote a sentence, it's probably not very good, I'm gonna try to separate myself, you know, from it, I'm gonna look at it as dispassionate as I can and try to find what's wrong with it, so that I can improve it, you know, constantly looking at whatever you've got or whatever you've done and trying to improve it. And of course, the dance there is you don't want to go too far. You don't want to be so obsessed and or self-critical that you never get any pleasure out of what you're doing, because that would be a very unhappy life. But you want to have just enough so that you're spending a lot of your time being critical and trying to improve yourself. And also, occasionally, at least occasionally, sitting back and going, okay, that's a good feeling after spending 3 years on this book, hey, that's not a bad book. You know, it's okay.
Are you speaking from experience, sir?
I am. When I'm talking about the sentences in the book, I'm definitely putting myself in my own shoes and telling you how I feel about this stuff. And sometimes that's the most useful way to talk about it.
Audience, if you have questions, you can reach us by email at live@skepticallyspeaking.com or on Twitter at Skeptical Radio. And we'll be right back with more on genetics, talent, hard work, and intelligence right after this. Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. We're here with David Shank, author of The Genius in All of Us, Why Everything You've Been Told About Genetics, Talent, and IQ is Wrong. David, do you see this kind of remarkable achievement that we're talking about as being equally available to everybody then? Could everybody have been an astronaut?
To say it's equally available, to say every endeavor and every level of achievement in every realm is equally available is going way too far. And I'm actually very clear about that in my book, right in the introduction. But what we can say is that really the genome itself is designed to be adaptive, and the brain, after it forms, is also it's an adaptive machine. That's one of the key features of humanity, is that we are adaptive beings. And and along with that, I think I'm fairly confident in saying that there is an extraordinary amount of untapped potential in virtually all of us. And of course, I'm not including people who are born with severe genetic afflictions, an extra chromosome or what have you. But people who are born with a basic, functional working genome, I think have an extraordinary amount of potential if they're exposed to the right resources. And the other thing to say, kind of in this overarching realm, is that and this is absolutely solidly true, you just don't know what your own individual potential is unless and until you expose yourself, or your parents and your culture around you helps expose you to an extraordinary amount of resources. Most of us are going to grow up and live to a ripe old age and die without ever having come even close to our potential in a wide variety of areas. And I don't mean that as a horrible thought. I mean, that's okay. We have to live our lives, and we may not, it may not even be a very healthy thing to want to be extraordinarily good at something, because it involves all sorts of sacrifices and costs. But I think if we shift the conversation, again, as I said earlier, away from this idea that talent and intelligence are these things, and more toward this idea that it is a process that we can better understand, then I think that our whole approach to these things in education and parenting and in all sorts of cultural ways is going to be healthier.
Do you think that this kind of persistent effort that we're talking about can actually overcome genetic shortcomings?
Yeah, sure. I mean, look at the basketball players who are kind of laughably short for their profession now. Of course, it wasn't too many decades ago that the being under 6 feet wasn't actually all that much of a liability in basketball. In fact, there's this funny little anecdote in the book about how they used to say that Jews were genetically great at basketball, because there was a time where Jewish Americans actually dominated the game.
Right.
And they would come up with these descriptions of how supposedly we had all these qualities that were built into us that just made us extra wily and so on and so forth. Well, so now things have changed, and so the kind of lazy thinkers about this say, well, it's the blacks that have the genetic talent for basketball, and so the whites are working, have to work extra hard and go against their genetic predispositions or whatever. No, I think that we can do an extraordinary amount to overcome whatever our genetic shortcomings are. But I would, I have to answer it I have to broaden my question, my answer somewhat to say that I don't think, technically speaking, except in fairly rare circumstances, we have things that I would call genetic shortcomings, because genes themselves don't in any way directly determine many things about our lives. And whether something is a genetic shortcoming, really, it's going to be a gene environmental shortcoming. And let me give you, if you can give me like 2 minutes to do a little thought experiment, I can tease this out a little
Absolutely.
Bit.
Absolutely.
Okay. So let's take, one of the things I want to help people get past, and this is going to take a while, but in our culture, it's not going to happen tonight. But this idea of how we talk about genes having predispositions. So right now, there's a gene out there that that they've discovered is supposedly gives you a predisposition to baldness. And they use that term because 80% of the people with this particular genetic variant are bald, and only 20% have hair. One of the little ironies of this is that Steven Pinker, who writes quite a bit about genetics and actually had his own genome decoded, and he is one of the guys who has the quote-unquote baldness gene, but he has famously a big, beautiful head of hair that I'd love, I'd kill to have that head of hair. So right now we call that a gene that has a genetic, we call that a genetic predisposition to baldness. But it's actually quite plausible that in the coming years, we're going to discover that if a pregnant woman with a fetus that has this exact gene takes a certain amount of, I'm just going to, hypothetically say, folic acid at a certain day of pregnancy, that that all of a sudden the percentages could be flipped, that 80% of the people with that exact gene will end up having a big full head of hair, and only 20% would be bald. And if we're still using the word predisposition, we will suddenly be saying that this gene gives us a predisposition to have a full head of hair throughout our lives. My point of that thought experiment is to say, I'm not saying that exact scenario is going to happen, but the point is that we are ascribing a certain power to genes on their own that simply doesn't exist. And we're in this really weird period where we're using terms like probabilistic as if genes are dice, which is also not true, and predisposition as if genes push us in a certain direction, which actually isn't true. It's a particular gene or set of genes that's interacting with a certain environment, which might be very common right now, and so therefore most of the people in a certain culture are ending up with a certain thing, so it looks like the gene is pushing it, but it's not the gene pushing it, and that we can change things. We might end up learning more about this. We will end up learning more about this interaction, and we'll end up changing things, and we'll end up realizing that to say that this certain gene had a predisposition in this direction was a very silly way of describing genes. I hope that makes some sense.
Well, I was going to ask, how do geneticists feel about your book? What kind of reception are you getting from them?
So far, great. I've run it past quite a number of geneticists. First of all, I could not have written this book without consulting many, and that means not just talking to them, but showing them stuff that I was writing along the way and making sure that I was getting it right, and having them say in many occasions, hey, you're going a little too far in this direction, you're not quite getting this right. So there was that part of the vetting process. And since the book has come out, I've also had lots of great reception. In fact, one of the high honors of my career, I would say, was getting a blurb from Rudy Tanzi, who's got to be in the top 10 geneticists in the country up at Harvard. It's now, having said that, I wouldn't be surprised to hear that some geneticists are going to take issue with what I'm saying, because what I'm doing is I'm not just putting pure science out in a book for people to see. I'm trying to bridge an understanding of science between what the way scientists talk about stuff, amongst themselves, and the way the public understands stuff. And that's always going to be using, basically coming up with terms and metaphors and ways of description that is not just simplifying, but telling certain stories and making certain comparisons. And that's always going to be a part of an argument and a conversation, which is, a very healthy process.
So this is basically a hopeful message from you. But not something like The Secret, though. You know, I just want to clarify, this is not something like, you know, if we want it badly enough, we can get it regardless of what it is.
Yeah, I mean, anyone who thinks that they're hearing, and I hope after a whole hour, you know, they're hearing a very simple message. But anyone who sees the book title, a lot of people see the book title and go, oh, simple message. I've seen this before. He's saying hard work, you know, can get everyone to be genius. That's obviously not true, blah, blah, blah. No, the point here is that there is actually a tremendous amount of nuance, and we can all benefit from a much deeper conversation. If people prefer a simple, mythical truth, that's out there and they can have it. But if people want to get a few steps closer to the reality and aren't afraid of a little nuance, then I think hopefully this is the book for you, and it's helping to be a part of a conversation which I think is going to be, you know, really interesting to have in the coming years.
David, on that note, I can't imagine a better place to end that. Thanks very much for being here today.
Well, again, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate your interest, and keep up the great work.
Thank you. You can visit David's website at davidshank.com, and you can visit our site at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, click the links that take you to our Facebook page, to us on Twitter, and to iTunes, where you can subscribe to the show. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on. The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell. Break the spell of Pavlov's bells. Cause we're skeptically speaking. Online reading tarot cards and witches, psychics, and their spoon-bending mind tricks. All the humbug, flim-flam, frauds and shams, the charlatan who I don't think you understand. It's the hocus-pocus, out-of-focus locus, eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless. Let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor. Leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore. Just a microscope, telescope, magnifier, reading in between the lines of these lies. Bring it on. The skeptics await your letter, your call, tweet, homing pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're skeptically speaking.
On Skeptically Speaking, we discuss a wide range of skeptical and science topics with a variety of experts. But I'd like to remind you that you, yes, you personally, are invited to join us on air every week for Speaking Up. Because let's face it, outreach is a part of skepticism. We all do it, whether we're talking to our parents about why they shouldn't buy into that multi-level marketing scheme, explaining the misinformation around vaccines to our coworkers, or forwarding that Snopes entry on why typing in your PIN number backward on the ATM machine does not, in fact, summon the police. But if you want to take your skeptical activism one step further and reach a broader audience, we're here for you. Do you have an event coming up that you'd like to promote? Or maybe you're a blogger that's been doing some great work and you'd like to talk about it? Or you'd just like to get some experience speaking publicly on a science or skeptical topic? What better way to get some real-world practice than on a friendly, rational radio show? If you're ready to have your say, do send an email to feedback@skepticallyspeaking.com. Put Speaking Up in the subject line, tell us a bit about what you'd like to discuss, and we'll contact you to set up your very own 10 to 15 minutes of on-air goodness. We're looking forward to hearing from you. Skeptically Speaking is brought to you by our fantastic production team. Producer Mike, Skype Ninja Grant, Ustream Wrangler Ryan, Web Guy Jarrett, and resident artist Jill. Thanks for tuning in.